I'm Liz, and like the sirens of Scream, I like a good scare. So I started interviewing my neighbors about their haunted homes and got way more than I bargained for. Check out my podcast, Ghosts in the Burbs, about the people of Wellesley, Massachusetts, and the ghosts and monsters who haunt them.
Such sights to show you.
Hello, and welcome to the 44th episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm your host, Melissa Megan, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Jackie DeVore.
Hello.
And Sierra Houck.
Hello.
Tonight, we're also joined by superstar editor, musician, bunny wrangler, and toddler costume designer, the talented Shauna Gore.
Hey!
Hello!
Thanks for joining us tonight.
How are y'all doing?
We are lovely.
I'm happy to be here. Oh, good. You are lovely. You really are.
Oh, thank you. We've been talking about getting you on this show for quite a while, because you have all kinds of horror, like random and vast horror nuggets to share with us, and I just want to pick your brain tonight. So
yeah,
hopefully it's not painful.
Yeah. Oh no, it won't be. I expressed this to Melissa earlier. I just hope I'm horror-y enough because you know I sort of have my pockets of horror that I really really dig, and some of it I stay away from, but. You know, I think everybody's like that.
We're gonna drag it out of you.
Okay.
We'll find it. So the first thing we like to do when we have a guest before we get down into the nitty gritty here is like we like to do something called Grill the Guest, where we're just gonna throw a couple of fun horror themed questions at you to sort of see where your horror background lies, okay?
Gotcha. Okay.
It's like Horror Jeopardy. Okay, so the first question is, the zombies are at your door. What weapon do you grab? How do you sneak out of the house unnoticed? And then what is your plan?
See, here's the thing about this. My plan in a zombie invasion is to stay put because I have a killer basement. And I've got some earthquake supplies down there. And I've been thinking about this question since I was probably 6 years old. And I've always lived my life in such a way that I hoard all the really important stuff. Like there's tons of books in my house and there's a lot of canned food. So I figure when that happens, I might be better off staying put. So
if that happens, we should all head to Shauna's house.
Head to my house. I've got big, heavy furniture to move in front of the doors and lots of entertainment, lots of like analog, non-electric entertainment and some big knives and a couple of baseball bats. So I guess that's about, you know, but I do keep really
sounds
interesting.
Like a party.
Yeah, I keep good canned food in the house because earthquake kits are big in Oregon. So, you know, a little bit like maybe a little bit a step up from baked beans as far as what you'll be living on for the next 6 months. You know,
it's going to take Jackie and I a lot longer to get there than Sierra.
Yeah,
she's at least in the right state.
Yeah, we might need to find an East Coast guest.
Jackie and I will be doing that like post-apocalyptic road trip where we have to try to make it all the way across the country. We'll pick up some new weapons on the way.
Good. We'll use them. We'll need them by then. Maybe some more canned food, but you know.
Probably a dog.
Yeah, so that's always,
you know.
A dog would be good. Dog would be good.
I don't know. Sierra's got a couple of those already. There might not be any more room for dogs.
Two dogs, two cats. Yeah, at that point, there would be two cats in the house. Hopefully, there'll be a rabbit again in the house soon. So
a whole bunch of bunnies is what I'll be bringing with
bunny
me.
Bunny army. Yeah.
I just got this picture in my head of like Jackie and I doing like the cross-country post-apocalypse road trip. Like, we don't have room for any people that we pass along the way because we're pretty much driving with the ark.
Yep.
Like, I think that, well, you know,
an RV full of bunnies, cats, and dogs.
Honestly, the fewer people, the better, probably. So, you know, I mean, I realize how mercenary that is for me to say, but whatever.
If you could be any monster, creature, horror villain, who would you want to be, and who would you most likely be, like, you know, in reality, I guess, when it really happens?
Oh, geez. Boy. It's weird that the first answer that pops into my head is Pumpkinhead.
Interesting.
And it may just because I love that movie so damn much, and I would love to actually exist in that atmosphere. Right, you know, like, I love that movie and I can watch it constantly. So I think I would just like to, for, you know, half an hour, walk around in the swamps like that, and it would be sort of cool.
You have a lot of people you want to get revenge on?
I don't. I could, you know, like, if you could set it in Washington, D.C., I could do some damage.
There you go.
I could see, like, Pumpkinhead in Congress could be pretty effective. So
Pumpkinhead 2, really draining the swamp.
Really draining the swamp. Totally, totally. So that, I'm going to stick with that just because that's the best thing that came into my head. And it's really unlikely I would ever be a horror villain because I'm way too nice. So that's just not going to happen otherwise.
I think being a villain would be hard for you. I could see that.
It would be so hard. I'm sort of a goodie.
Have a bunny.
Have a bunny. Everybody just pet bunnies. It's fine. You'll be happy.
And the third question we have for you is, what is the first horror movie that you remember watching? Like, deep cuts.
Ooh.
Here.
So it was either Frankenstein or The Bride of Frankenstein. A lot of my horror stuff comes from hanging out with my dad, who was a big horror nut. And from the time I was very, very little, like, inappropriately toddler little, he used to watch horror movies around me all the time.
That seems to be a common thread with us here.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet. I think I've talked about this a little bit with Melissa before. And yeah, I specifically remember how physically small I was. And I was standing up on the couch behind my dad's body. Like, my dad was sitting there on the couch watching TV, and he's a really big guy. Yeah. And I was fully standing up behind him, sort of cowering, watching both Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. Because it was scary. Yeah, it was scary, but I loved it, too. And that, you know, that sort of defines horror in your childhood. It's scary, but I love it, and I can't stop watching.
Can't look away.
Yeah, so both of those movies are really special to me. And, I mean, we just used to watch the sort of old black and white horror movies on Saturdays on TV in LA in the 70s and 80s, you know, so all those movies are pretty special.
You definitely have, like, probably way more, like, classic horror roots than any of us do then.
Yeah, I am definitely, you know, I love supernatural and spooky horror. I specifically do not like slasher films very much. There are a couple that I have, like, I have great affection for Halloween, actually the whole franchise. Like, I just love John Carpenter, and I can take things from a John Carpenter movie that I can't take from another director sometimes. You know, and I like Wes Craven stuff too, but the contemporary, you know, really bad, violent, brutal people on people violent stuff really leaves me cold. And I get how people like it and why they do. But for me, it's just a real nope. And I go straight toward, like, give me a ghost or a demon or a witch, you know, any of those really awesome things, and I'm down. And some people are the other way. Some people can't, you know, the supernatural stuff really freaks them out, but they can watch people stab each other all day. And I can't do that. So, you know, it's just one of the ways we are individuals here.
Yeah. I feel like my taste, like, progressed where I started when I was young watching slasher films with my dad. Like, that was my roots of horror, were, like, Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and, like, The Hills Have Eyes, you know, it's very slashery. And now I much prefer, like, supernatural, ghost, spooky things. But I also think that what we consider slasher films has sort of like turned into torture porn now.
There's not
much of that classic slasher film anymore.
Yeah, and I do really get the appreciation for the filmmaking when you're talking about special effects and how to do like the realistic gore stuff. But it's funny. I mean, my last name is Gore, and people used to think that that was my pseudonym for editing horror comics. And it was so funny because it would be the wrong one for me. Like, I'm not into gore. I'm very much into, you know, the other.
That's funny. I was going to ask if that was your real last name or not.
So, yeah, it is indeed my real last name. I think all the gores are related, like literally every gore in America is related. So I am actually related to Al Gore. He was my dad's second cousin. And so it really is like one big family. Some of whom are a little bit weirder. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
You're the Portland branch of the gores.
I am the Portland gore. Yeah, exactly.
So I think we'll jump right into our recs from here. We usually like to share a couple of things that we've been enjoying lately that are horror related, sort of. Sometimes we stretch it a little bit. Sierra, why don't you start us off this week and tell us what you're into, because I want to hear about one of these things on your list.
Okay, well, first I want to start out talking about two ladies who actually live in Seattle, who I really want to be friends with. Their names are Christy and Ashley, and they host a podcast called That's Weird, and it runs the gamut of true crime and ghosts and cryptids, and they are really cool ladies, very, very much akin to the three of us. So I'm fingers crossed maybe we'll do a crossover or something, because I've been listening to their all their episodes, and it's like, oh, I love that. Oh, the Jersey Devil. Oh, man. Talking about Sasquatches and different ghosts and all that kind of thing. So
fun.
Yeah.
Love it.
And then the other thing is that yesterday I went and saw A Quiet Place.
Ooh.
And which everybody's been raving about. I went in not really knowing anything about what it's about. I thought, just from the very, very short trailer and from the title, that it was more of like a home invasion kind of thing. But it's very much like monsters and like kind of alien, kind of like the monsters reminded me of like skinwalkers. If you guys have seen or can picture them.
Yeah.
Or they're kind of like also kind of like bug creatures a little bit. They're weird, but it's very much a more of a post-apocalyptic kind of survival movie. And it has Jim from The Office.
Yeah, how does he hold up in this?
He did really well. I think he also, like, directed or produced it.
I think he did. He, like, directed and produced.
Yeah, it seemed like a real passion project.
And was a writer on
it,
too.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he did a good job. It's very, very family oriented. So Melissa might need to steel herself a little bit before watching it. Their kids are in trouble a lot. And then the parents feel really bad that they can't protect the kids against these like horrible creatures.
Yeah, that's
horrifying. I'm going to have nightmares about this.
Probably. I'm warning you now. The very basic premise is that these monsters show up on Earth, and it's not explained how or where they came from. The story picks up about 3 months or so into these creatures arriving, and they're blind, and they are very, like, heavily armored. They're hard to attack, and they hunt people based on sound. So there's lots of shots of, like, newspapers and things being like, it's sound, be quiet to be safe.
Yeah.
And so this family has adapted to this lifestyle where they don't really talk. They just whisper to each other. And one of the daughters is deaf, so they know sign language, which is probably how they've been able to survive so far. And it's about them trying to stay quiet and all the ways that you accidentally make noise. And of course, there are these little kids, and little kids make tons of noises, and you eventually find out that the mother is pregnant. So they have to deal with how they're going to have a baby and not let the baby cry kind of thing. So that's very scary.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say I love stories, especially horror stories, where they don't go into the premise very much. Mm-hmm. Or they let the premise just stand and they don't overexplain it. I think that's a really effective horror tool, and I love movies that do that.
Yeah, and they do a good job of just dropping you into it, and you only know as much information as the characters know, and even then it's very little. They don't know how to defeat these things. They only know that they can stay safe by staying quiet, and it's very much like, we are just surviving. We don't even know how to, like, attack or take back our society at this point. It's just, this is life now.
Just survival, yeah.
Yeah. There's a few really interesting things about this movie. I think, first of all, if you don't know, John Krasinski and Emily Blunt are actually married in real life. And Millicent Simmons, the girl, is actually deaf. She's been deaf since she was a baby.
Oh, that's neat.
So, So, this very is authentic. Her second film, yeah. Very authentic. I've been hearing about this for a long time because it was actually filmed in several towns around me. So everybody around here locally has been talking about it forever because, you know, people posting like, oh, they're on my neighbor's farm or they're over here. So, like, we've been excited for it to come out just to see what it's going to amount to. And I heard that they somewhere in the credits that they thank several towns around me where they film it. And it's going to be interesting to see, like, which farms I can recognize because I just by looking at the pictures, it looks like every farm that I know around my house. So
that might make it more scary. It might make it scarier.
Yeah, more real.
You know? Yeah, that you get to see your surroundings.
So I'm looking forward to seeing it, but we haven't been able to find a sitter yet to go and see a scary movie. So
Don't take Max. Don't take him.
No. Jackie, what do you have for us this week?
A couple things. First up being this Netflix documentary called Killer Legends. This actually ties really well into our last episode, and I kind of wish I saw it before our last episode. But this documentary and duo explore four different famous urban legends, like the Hook on the Hand, the clowns, and a couple others, and what true life murder kind of things inspired those urban legends. For instance, did you guys know that the whole Hook on the Hand thing pretty much originated with a Dear Abby letter in the newspaper?
No.
Ooh.
It was it was a weird story that I guess Abby wrote up to basically act as a warning to couples who would go out to Couples Point in the car and make out, to warn them about the dangers of premarital sex and that whole culture there.
Typical. But
they used a very morbid way to get that point across, and then it just totally exploded from there. So, yeah, it was a very weird thing for them to do. But anyway, this documentary, it really goes to some very interesting and detailed places. The documentarians are very well researched. One thing that they did kind of frequently that I'm not sure I feel good about is that they would go and interrupt people who lived in the spots where tragedies happened like decades ago. Be like knock on the door like, hey, did you know that this brutal murder happened here? Are you aware that this happened?
Like, it was like in the 60s. Like, oh my God.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I'm like, what are they trying to accomplish there? Like, are they hoping to see the ghost of the people that died there? Like, I don't understand what their purpose is in doing that, but it is, I guess it's interesting.
I wonder if they ever got like punched in the face by somebody. Right. On my porch. Right. This kept popping up on my recommendations on Netflix. And so I'm glad you brought it up because I keep staring at it and like, is it going to be good? I don't know. Looks kind of old. I'm not sure.
I realized Jackie messaged me about this. I realized that I did watch it. I only remember the clown part, though. I don't know what I was doing that was distracting me from the rest of it. So I got to rewatch it.
You mentioned that the Cropsey stuff. Have you seen a documentary where they were talking about Cropsey?
I saw the whole documentary on that. I think I talked about it like way back in one of our first episodes.
Yeah, I think
do you remember the name of it?
It's the one that's just
really want to see it.
Cropsey.
I think it's just called Cropsey. Yeah.
Well, that makes it easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's just called Cropsey.
Yeah, they mentioned it. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I saw Cropsey. I love that.
Is it good? Yeah, they mentioned it briefly at the very beginning of this other documentary, so I really want to see it. Like, they mentioned it in a very interesting way.
It is. It's an interesting documentary, but they don't get to the heart of what it really was. And I sort of, it's funny, I need to watch it again because it was really riveting and really interesting, but there was sort of no conclusion about it. So it seemed like it was still sort of just an urban legend, but I felt like there was supposed to be more to it.
I want to say it almost felt like it was like they got a couple people in the neighborhood to like talk about what they heard about Cropsey. You know, so yeah, like they talk about it, but it's not really anybody from the outside sort of like really diving into what it, you know, what's behind it and like what's the conclusion of it. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, there was sort of like you usually hope that there is some kind of like, we talked to the police and this is the real thing. Yeah,
some kind of resolution.
It wasn't any of that. Mm. Yeah, it was just like everybody's afraid of Cropsey. And even, I mean, that just the name or the title, whatever it is like, it is really whatever the hell Cropsey is. It's terrifying. But, you know, they don't really answer it because it's atmospheric and cool. But, you know.
I'm pretty sure
this was done by the same people, the Killer Legends documentary. They mention it in the very beginning, and it sounds like what they learned from Cropsey, they basically took and turned into this other documentary. So,
interesting. Okay, well, that could work. I think that, like, I felt like Cropsey was a really good first attempt at something. Yeah. So maybe that's what they did.
And the other thing I have today is this graphic novel that I got for Christmas, and I just recently started reading it. It's The Afterlife with Archie, and it is literally Archie, like the classic Archie comic with zombies. It's a lot of fun. It's got it's very interesting the way it kind of balances classic Archie with the whole Riverdale craze that's going on now, and it's dark in a fun way. It is very much just Archie with zombies. So if you're into Archie at all and or zombies, then this is a fun little ride here. There are a couple of things I need to photograph to put on our Siren social media, because they say sometimes the dead is better, like a lot. So it's like, oh, it's like they're calling
Hell
to
yeah.
us.
Yeah, I think Afterlife with Archie and The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, too. Those both series have been doing really, really well.
Yeah, I have the first Sabrina book, too, so I'm going to read that one next. And I'm really excited about that one.
I think they've come up quite a few times.
Yeah, I haven't seen the Sabrina book, but I'd really like to.
Shauna, did you have any recommendations you wanted to share with us? Anything?
I have a book that I just started reading again, because the first time I tried to crack it and just started getting into it, it disappeared, which means it just got filed away on one of our bookshelves and I couldn't find it for months. Because our house is literally nothing but bookshelves, pretty much. It's a short novel called Star Creek by a guy based here in Portland named Nathan Carson. And it's the obvious comparison would be it's sort of Stranger Things-ish in that it's set in the 80s and it focuses on a teenager. And I've actually only just cracked it again. Like, I'm on chapter two now. I mean, it should be a really quick read. Nathan is he's a local guy. He's actually a heavy metal promoter, and he plays drums in a really cool band called Witch Mountain. And he's sort of a dilettante in the best use of that word. He does a lot of different things. And a couple of years ago, he took a crack at writing a horror novel. And it's really engaging. Yeah, I really like it. I really like the tone of it. I like the way he writes. So I'll report back when I finish it, hopefully in a couple of days. And I like that. And the other book I have waiting is the novel The Ritual. Did you guys see that movie that's on? It's on Netflix now.
I think Sierra just talked about it. Didn't Sierra talk about it a few episodes back? Yeah, I'm pretty sure Sierra recommended it like a few episodes ago.
Yeah. So, and it's based on a novel by this British writer, Adam Neville, who I'd heard really good things about from Yola, Hellboy's creator.
Uh-huh.
So that's a high recommendation. I love the movie, and I'm always really happy to find horror novels that, tell the kind of story I like, and that, you know, that you guys probably heard that, you know, the story is very sort of like ancient monster focused and very woodsy and sort of pagan druid stuff. A lot of really cool sort of naturalistic stuff in it.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to get into that book too. But I've been promising myself I would get through Nathan's book first before I pick up anything else. So one at a time, Sean.
Well, yeah. And you got new stuff going on too, so you know.
I have a few things going on.
Back to the deadline life, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. I mean, it's hard for me to find. I don't have a really hard time finding time to read just for entertainment because I read all the time for work.
Yeah.
So my eyes get, you know, especially the older I get, my eyes get so tired and I get all excited about reading in bed and then I fall asleep within 5 minutes. So it's really hard to have that. I'm awake and I'm alert and now I'm going to read this book just for me. Those times are few and far between these days.
I have that problem even with comic books now. Like I try to sit down and read. If I try to read more than a couple issues and I start just like conking out and I can be sitting straight up in a chair and I just get sleepy.
I think, there's some kind of it's probably a mom hormone sleepy. It's like, what are you doing with your eyes? Just sleep. What are you doing? Go to sleep.
Like, you're not moving, so you should be sleeping. That's the rule.
Really? Yeah, seriously.
Your body's like, you're still asleep.
It is a lot of work on your brain to read. You know, I used to read so much and so quickly I just took it for granted and now I'm like, wow, my old brain is getting slow. It just takes me a longer time to get through a page sometimes. So but God, I love it. You know, it's like when you get time and can really do it, it is such a treat to just sit down and read it all.
Well, do you have anything else? You don't have to come up with something else.
But my recommendations are like those are the things I was really focused on right now. Yeah, and I don't even get a lot of time to watch stuff. You know, it's my big my husband is not a horror fan. So I literally just wait for him to leave the house so that I can hang out and watch a horror movie. Because that's he never tough. Wants to watch horror movies with me, except like some he'll indulge me a little bit around Halloween. But, you know, it's usually me and my pets and I say, okay, Ian, you go out for the night and I'll do something fun, which means usually hugging a cat or a bunny and watching a horror.
That sounds like a pretty good night to me.
But if I'm
sounds
lucky,
like a party. Yeah,
honestly, it is the best. It is really the best.
Well, I have a show to share that I think will be right up your alley, Shauna.
Ooh, okay.
It's on Netflix. It's called Requiem.
Ooh.
I don't know if this has popped up in you guys and your recommendations. So yeah, it's just started showing up for me the last couple of days. So, and I finally watched a little bit of it. I haven't gotten very far into it, but I'm really digging it so far. So it's basically about, let me see. It's a show. I think is there just one season of it right now? Yeah, it's a series. It's a Netflix series. There's 6 episodes right now. So it's about this woman who's a cello player and she is preparing to do this big concert that she's very nervous about and everything. And her mother kills herself like in front of her. Like moments before the concert and this traumatic and this happens. Right. This is not a spoiler. This is like in the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
But this event that takes place, you know, she sort of goes to her mom's house and starts digging through her stuff and ends up discovering this whole kind of like background story that her mother never told her about, where she discovers the story of like a toddler who disappeared from this little Welsh village years ago. And her mother has all of this like all these news stories and photos surrounding this girl's disappearance. And so she decides to go and like go to this town and find this house, this big like castle looks like in this photo and try to figure out like how her mother's attached to this missing child, kind of unearth the secret that her mom kept from
Interesting.
Her.
Interesting.
Yeah. Ooh. And it takes a really weird turn, like right from the first episode wraps up in a really nice way. But it's very creepy. And from the very beginning of it, like I think right off the bat, they established that there's something about like reflections where like there's this spooky thing that shows up when there's a reflection, and it seems to be an aggressive kind of being. And so there's, you know, which always gets me. It's such a cheap trick in horror, but like anytime there's a mirror or window or reflection of something, you know, and that person's like way over on one side of it, I'm like, oh God, something's in there.
You can't take your eyes off it. It's like other things can be going on in the room, but you know, the real thing's going to happen in that mirror.
Right. Like if there's blank space in the mirror, like next to the person on screen, you know that like something's going to show up there.
Absolutely.
And they kind of pull that. They kind of pull that trick at the beginning, and at first I was a little turned off by it because I was like, it feels a little bit cliche. But the characters really got interesting quickly, and the story took a really different turn than what I expected to. So I don't want to say too much, but it's very much like part supernatural thriller and part like psychological horror. From what I'm reading, it's being compared to like a 60s and 70s like Rosemary's Baby type feeling is where it's going to go. So. Yes. Yeah, I think it's really cool. It's got some really nice, like, creepy imagery in it. The woman who plays the main characters got cool hair. That helps.
It always does.
That totally helps. That totally helps.
It gets me.
I have to say, that whole, the reflection thing, I know it's just a trick, but it has worked for me since I was a very little kid.
Yeah.
I'm sure you guys, if you've never seen it, I'm sure you remember or have heard of the show In Search of, Leonard Nimoy's.
He's
crazy. And there is an episode of that about haunted castles in England. And one of the scariest things I remembered from my childhood is a very corny shot of, you know, somebody in a castle looking in a mirror, and this thing appears in the mirror behind her. And it blew my mind when I was like 6 years old. And to this day, I think about it. I probably think about that image at least once a week. You know, just as like, oh, I'm passing a mirror. I wonder if that thing's going to be in the mirror. But I just love that as a stupid horror trick. It totally works. And I think it's very
always effective.
Always effective. And
it calls back to that whole like Bloody Mary urban legend, right?
Yeah.
Thing when you're a kid stuff. And like, you don't look in the mirror and say Bloody Mary.
Yeah, that's one of those few.
Yeah, it's scary if it's supernatural, and it's scary if it's a person, you know. Like it's anytime that might happen, like the same effect like looking in a rear view window and having somebody be in your back seat, like it's that always like
Well, the other thing that I'm a sucker for that this show already features heavily is like, I hate when supernatural or like ghosts make sounds in movies. I don't like the creepy, like whispery, like words that are just low enough that you can't quite tell what they're saying all the time. But that just like gives me shivers every time. I just want silent ghosts. I don't want them to talk.
That reminds me.
Or at least talk loud enough that it's clear what you're saying. Like, I hate the whole whispery, like moving voices thing.
Yeah.
That reminds me, Melissa, I'm playing a video game right now that like really heavily features that, and you are not going to like it. It's probably going to be my...
What is it?
It's Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice.
I keep being told to play it, and every time I look at it, I'm like, I want to play it, but it's scary.
You're going to have a lot of trouble with this one, but I just started, so I might actually bring you in on a few play sessions so that you can get a feel for it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I want to see it. Like, I want to see it played because it's a gorgeous game. So the other thing I want to recommend is a new comic book series called Gideon Falls. There's now 2 issues out. And this is from the stories from Jeff Lemire, who is an amazing storyteller.
Ooh,
Art is from Andrea Sorrentino. And then there's variant covers from an artist named Jock, who I think is amazing, too. It's really cool. It's a weird story. I don't know where it's going to go yet with 2 issues in, but it's been really intriguing so far. It's one of those kind of like parallel stories. There's a couple things going on, like, you know, parallel to each other with different people. There's a young guy who seems to have this kind of like paranoid conspiracy theory thing going on, where he's running around and he's digging in garbage in the city. And he's finding like these nails and these kind of like weird spikes sticking out of the ground, and he's collecting them and dating them and like taking them back to this weird like reclusive lab that he's built in his house. And he's become really obsessed with like he's like uncovering something that's happening that people don't see.
But is he just crazy pants pretty much?
I don't know. He's also, you know, the first issue features conversations between him and his psychologist. So like she's trying to tell him that he's crazy or that he's paranoid and these things aren't really happening. They're in his head.
Mm.
But he's got quite a good collection at home of things that he's pulled out of the trash that seem to connect to each other. So I don't think he's totally crazy.
Yeah, I like that as a premise a lot.
Yeah, and then there's this whole other parallel story of this this Catholic priest who's sent off to this small town called Gideon Falls, where something, their priest who's been there for like 30 years recently passed away. So they send this guy who's had a rough background. We don't know yet what kind of bad things he's done, but he's been sent to this small town to help these people and basically take over that position. And you get the feeling that he's being kind of like intentionally sent away to be kept away from somebody or out of the spotlight somehow. He very quickly, the first night he's in this new town in Gideon Falls, the priest who's supposed to be dead, who he's replacing, shows up and like starts leading him on some kind of creepy, like middle of the night, like,
oh no,
scavenger hunt through a field. So it's like it goes all kinds of strange places. And at the center of this book is this mysterious black barn that's like appearing and disappearing for different people at different times.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's really cool. If there's one thing that Jeff Lemire is great at, it's like he winds these stories that seem at the surface like they're going to be very like normal kind of, you know, this is a story of a crazy person. And then it turns into like there's some kind of weird supernatural thing happening that other people aren't seeing, you know?
Yeah. I love that stuff.
Yeah, he's really good at that. So, but this is a book I've been hearing about for a while. People have been excited about it coming, and two issues in, I'm like, all right, I'm in for the long run on this one.
I will go buy that tomorrow. That sounds perfect.
Jeff Lemire is like, I don't always love his like superhero stories, but his people stories, when he writes stories about real people and like weird creepy things happening, he always makes me cry.
Yeah.
And he always has like, yeah, he does a really good job at writing like genuine people with like hardship.
Think he's a very humanistic kind of writer for sure.
Right. So I think this is really interesting to see something that's so, that feels so like horror right off the bat from him.
It's cool. I think the last thing I read by him was Essex County, which was a collection of shorter stories. And there was one, it's been a few years since I've read it, but you know, that is more, there are a couple of stories that are like horror tinged, not exactly, you know, they're not hard horror stories at all, but I always like that kind of thing where it's like a really humanistic story, but there's a little bit of creepy stuff in there so that you don't know quite what's going on or if this person is crazy. I love that weird, you know, uncertain.
Yeah, and it pulls you into the like connecting with the main characters and everything too, so that's always helpful.
So that's a great recommendation. I think
most of his stories are based around an underdog of some kind, like a person who is like down and out or on the lower rungs, misunderstood. Kind of beaten down. We've been covering, I think, more and more comics on the show here. I'm definitely doing my best to get the girls like seriously into comics more. It's been really fun to like pull out kind of old comics that I really love and share them, and also like explore new things on the show. So
that's great. And it's, you know, in comics today, I, as someone who works in the industry, I find it very intimidating to feel like you can keep up with everything, because there are so many, you know, so many platforms for releasing comics, and a lot of people are just sort of getting out there and self-publishing again, and I think it's hard to keep up. So a show like this that will make a recommendation that's really considered is great. So much stuff out there.
I think before, we're going to talk about tons and tons of comics. We're going to take a really quick break, and then we have a lot of comic book stuff to talk about, because that's Shauna's awesome. Shauna's world. It was, and it is again.
It is again, yeah.
In the sky with more diamonds than a carpet from The Shining. Port Riot, Port Orion. We jarred a lot of lightning up. Shook a turkey leg or ten. Maybe we deserve a day of rest. Not
to mention. Alex up the street called, said he saw a bobcat. Check your trash can lids, notify your comrades. I said I'll take first watch. 1 a.m. defend the whole block. Hey, yo, the coyote, summon the ghosts of blown diodes. Open and moving like a luchador with no eye holes. Fried where the pipes froze. Life goes Lovecraft, Christ pose. Sitting on invisible hubcaps. Call Alex back, daggers in a basil patch. Tell him maybe less badminton, more Scrabble Dash. Less darts, more rum and cube, whatever. Keep the scallywags wrapped up in a subterfuge. Gussied up, guarded, and wearing the same armor as the night he argued. Till he dapped his mans up at departures. I could drive into a lake of fire, pay the piper COD. I wear the pot and kettle shop, a little toxin equally at least. It's probably more the kid than the kid. Either way, a vital widget in the system is sick. I see your symptoms in the hinges, hit the room all at once. All I could do is plug the roof with my gum. But now I gotta call Alex back. Coyotes in the castle grass. Tell him maybe less freeze tag, more hack and slash. I said I'll take first watch. 1 a.m. defend the whole block.
So we're back. And we are gonna dig into a nice convo with Shauna Gore about past, present, and maybe future comic book and horror projects. I guess, Shauna, I think maybe the first thing we should talk about is your new job, because you just started that.
I did yesterday.
Awesome. Congratulations.
That's so exciting.
It is. Thank you. It's really big. It's actually huge for me because I really thought I might never work for a publisher again as a staff member, just because the comics industry is small and I didn't want to move around the country a lot from job to job. So yeah, when I left Dark Horse in 2011, and I've been freelance since then. So that's a long time to not have like a home base with a publisher.
So you were recently brought on as a new editor for Lion Forge Comics, which is a smaller kind of indie company, right?
You know, it is an independent company, but it is.
I mean, in terms of indie comics.
Yeah, it's gearing up to be a bigger company. It's very, very interesting. It's owned by two really amazing Black men who have a huge interest in making comics literally for everybody, because there are so many people, both, you know, readers of comics and people who make comics, who are really, really underrepresented in the mainstream comics industry. And I mean, I've always felt that as somebody working in comics, it's definitely been an old boys club mentality for a very long time. And I can only imagine what it would be like to be a person of color who wanted to break into comics. And, you know, I've heard people, friends of mine who are, you know, I'm friends with one Black writer in comics, this guy, David Walker, who's really awesome. And he's a great guy I've hired. And Lion Forge has been working with him, too. And, you know, he told me once about, and I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, when he first wanted to write comics, somebody said to him, well, we don't have any Black characters that need to be written right now.
Wow.
And it's like that, you know, like, I think it's that kind, it has been that kind of mentality for a long time that, you know, Black creators can only do Black characters, and who knows how many people have an interest in a Black character. So let's just stick to the mainstream stuff. And, you know, I mean, there's just so much wrong happening in that kind of situation. So yeah. Lion Forge's mission statement is literally to make comics for everyone and by everyone. And if you have characters that are characters of color, they try to hire creators for those series that are people of color, so they can have an authentic representation of that experience. And that's something I'm all for. So yeah, I'm excited about that. And in general, it's also just, it's a new, youngish company. They've actually been around, I believe, since 2011, but they got their start doing digital comics and sort of trying out these licenses. And it seemed like they were really trying to sort of just ramp up and literally practice making comics so they could get good at it. And they've been getting better at it. And so in the last couple of years, they went from digital to print, and now they're expanding their line and hiring more editors and looking at more acquisitions. So it's a pretty exciting time to be in a company like this.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm stoked. I'm very, very happy about
it. Yeah, I wasn't actually aware of Lionforge, Shauna, until you told me about the new job.
Oh, yeah.
But I've been like going through some of their books, and it's really impressive just the vast like variety of kinds of books that they're putting out, you know?
Yeah.
Everything from horror, sci-fi to like little love stories and superheroes and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, they have a kids line that is really adorable, and my son likes, I've gotten a couple of books for him from the line, and he really likes them. And they, one of our collections, this guy named Mike Kennedy, who I've known for a long time in comics publishing, ran a small publisher called Magnetic for a while, and he basically partnered with Lionforge to relaunch Magnetic. That's a really beautiful line of, a lot of them are imported European comics. So sort of higher brow, you know, some people like to really differentiate between this kind of comic and that kind of comic, like, you know, graphic yeah. storytelling versus comics. It's all comics. But the Magnetic stuff is really finely curated with a particular eye for, particularly the art is really gorgeous.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so Lionforge is, they're doing a bunch of stuff right now, but, you know, I feel really good about going to work for them, because everyone I've talked to at the company and the people who hired me, they're all so smart and very critical thinkers. And that's not always the case with comics publishers, you know, like,
right.
there've been a, you know, and
yeah. You're kidding.
No, it's a thing. Yeah. And there are, you know, like there, these, they don't seem to be, there's this sort of, I don't know, an aesthetic or an ideal in the comics industry that, you know, nobody wants to be a grown up and you just want to be a kid and have, you know, play things. And I've never really liked that. You know, I think there's nothing childlike about reading comics. It's not that we all want to be, you know, have an extended adolescence and never grow up. It's, you know, it's like
storytelling.
We're grownups, but we want good storytelling. So I like it.
And art.
And art, and, you know, and hopefully some poignant stuff in there and some real life kind of feelings. So I've never, you know, especially being a woman in the comics industry for 20 years now, when I first started, there really was this like, let's all be kids forever. But it really was like a boys' playground.
Mm.
And yeah.
It still is in a lot of places. Is. I mean, it's growing. It's growing.
It is. I mean, like the number of, like when I first started working at Dark Horse in 1997, it was probably, there were probably 20%, 25% female staffers. And when I left in 2011, it was more like half. And that was really nice. Awesome. And it's, I think it especially matters in editorial, because you have people making decisions about who are you going to hire to draw this story? Which writers are we interested in working with? And just the, you know, I was reading through the script notes of my boss, who is a really awesome woman named Andrea Colvin. And she comes from mainstream publishing in New York. And so I was just reading, I'm taking on one of the series that she had to drop when she started taking on higher role at the company. And just reading through her script notes today, I was so appreciative of the things she's calling out in these scripts about, hey, here you have two male characters talking about a woman's romantic status right in front of the woman. You know,
can we do a little better?
And so just that kind of basic common sense stuff that is really missing as a perspective. I mean, a lot of mediums, yeah. Not just comics. But I really appreciate that. So, you know, so I just have a lot of hopes that this company is structured differently. The focus and the audiences they want to reach are not necessarily your typical mainstream comics audiences. And it's because everybody at the company recognizes that certain people have been catered to way too much.
Yeah.
And other people have hardly been even recognized. So I just love that as a premise. Like, let's go out and make really awesome comics with people whose voices have not been heard a lot before.
It's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it puts the emphasis on, you know, finding new talent and digging up cool underground stuff that people have been working on for years that has never really found an audience. So I'm totally up for that challenge. I love it.
So, you just said you were at Dark Horse back in 1997. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I started working there when I was a wee little 24-year-old in 97. And then I worked.
And you kind of worked for them twice, right?
I did. I was hired as their publicist in 97. So I worked for 5 years in marketing. And almost instantly I knew that I wanted to get into editorial because marketing was never, I was not a marketing person. I was an English major. I was a story person. But, you know, you take the cool job at the cool comics publisher that's open. And it was fun. I liked the marketing job at first, but I really wanted to move into editorial. But there was sort of a political holdup. Like, I, for some reason, it was not cool for me to switch departments at that point. Mm-hmm. I think the departments were really competitive. I think my boss in marketing was really, really happy to have me. Mm-hmm. So he didn't want me to just transfer out of the department. So I actually left the company 5 years later and went to work in the music industry very briefly, which I hated with a hot passion that I can't even explain. Because I love music. I love, love, love music. And I'm a musician. But the industry side of it is very soulless. And it, you know, it was like distribution and promoting and stuff. And I just wasn't into it. I was not into it. So right when I was getting super miserable in that job, my phone rang. And it was literally, you know, one of my old friends at Dark Horse saying, "We're losing an editor and we want you to come back." And so I did a little happy dance and quit my job right away. And perfect went back timing. A lot of times, you know, my career in comics has had these sort of serendipitous moments like that of, I'm really tired of what I'm doing right now. I wish something would change. And then my phone rings and it's like, Dark Horse, nice. Come back. And I mean, and in a way, the Lion Forge job was really similar because I had actually tried to stop editing comics a few months ago and I had been headhunted by a printer in Hong Kong.
Oh,
and I was doing printer work for the last, and it was really interesting because I am a format mm-hmm. nerd and it was really cool to go from, you know, I'm underpaid as an editor working freelance for like 6 different companies to being, well, maybe this is my new career in comics. I'll take all my know-how in printing and publishing and sell printing from Hong Kong. But it was weird. I did. So when I went up to Emerald City Comic-Con in March, I knew I was up for the Lion Forge job and I knew that it was looking really good, but I technically went there as a printer rep and it was so weird. I was like, how can I be at a comic convention not as an editor? It's bizarre.
Yeah.
So I was glad I only had to do that one show like that. And the whole time I was like, but I also had this awesome interview with Lion Forge and I think they're going to hire me. So take this business card, but you might hear something else about me in 2 weeks. So anyway, like I said, it was sort of serendipitous that Lion Forge sort of opened up for editors right at this time when I was like, I don't know if I'm going to keep editing or not. I don't see any publishers that are worth it. Oh, hey, mm-hmm. here's Lion Forge. They look amazing. Right. And I have to say the whole experience, like the people at Lion Forge, like I said, they all seem very smart and very, you know, like I said, they're good critical thinkers, really creative people from a variety of backgrounds. And it was the nicest contract I've ever signed. Mm. Like the contract was written by a human for a human, and it made me feel wanted and valued.
So they didn't something up off the internet.
Kind of revolutionary.
they really seem to be approaching this from a totally different way than I've seen any publisher in this industry working yet. So I'm very impressed by that. And I think that the world needs that kind of shift in employers right now. You know, people need to be treated like they're human beings. And everything about their offer and the contract and going to work for them, starting the job in the last 2 days has been this really wonderful, like, wow, I feel appreciated and valued. And those aren't things I'm used to feeling necessarily working in comic. Yeah. So right now it all feels and looks really good from awesome. Where I'm standing. Yeah.
I feel like that started a little bit with like Milkfed. Are you familiar with Milkfed? Like Kelly Sue DeConnick's group that she kind of started up. Like there's this cool thing happening in comics where, you know, people who've been working on more indie projects who really want to see things done differently and like better representation and better demographics for the comics and, you know, more values behind the comics, kind of like just going, you know what, we're just going to make our own company where we do things the way that we want it done.
Yep.
And we're going to hire people who care mm-hmm. about that, you know, and just instead of like waiting for the big companies to do it for you, just like, fuck it. We're just going to make our own thing and make it work.
That honestly seems to be the way of younger America right now mm-hmm. in general.
Yeah, go millennials. Seriously, like I'm tired of people shit talking young people. Because they seem like the only people operating in this world with real core values that seem to matter and that they want to change things for the better, not just for themselves, but for everybody. So I hope that's the case.
So this might be a difficult question for you, but I'm interested. I love these kind of like fun, like simple things. If you can pull out of your brain, what are some of your favorite books that you've worked on and some of the most difficult books? Because I'm sort of interested in like what makes a book extra difficult in editing. I don't know a lot about editing, publishing.
Okay, I have clear answers for both of these.
Good.
So, yeah, my favorite, no surprise to Megan at least, probably is all the work I did with Bernie Wrightson. I edited, you know, and Bernie is a horror master and a legend and just a phenomenal presence in the whole history of horror, basically. So I worked with Bernie on, the original thing we did together was sort of his return to horror comics as it was promoted in the early 2000s. It was a series he did with Steve Niles called The City of Others. And it was basically sort of a zombie series, but it was also focused on this guy who was a hitman, and it was interesting, and it was sort of a horror thriller. But it was Bernie just really stretching and having a lot of fun and taking forever to draw these pages, which was a challenge. But that's the thing, like, you don't rush Bernie Wrightson to draw a page, and that's something that I think is really, really important. That, you know, I think the comics industry would be stronger overall if there was sort of a broader spectrum of work people could do. And Bernie had a hard time making comics professionally because he took a long time to draw, and everybody wanted him to draw like Bernie Wrightson, which means like sometimes it took
very complex,
incredibly detailed, just excruciatingly gorgeous, sinewy detail in every single thing in the panel. And people tried to rush in through that process. So the hardest thing about that book was building a schedule that Dark Horse would accept, because it's hard for a company to pay out in advance for a book that's not going to come out for a year.
Right.
So that's a real challenge with a lot of publishers. But we made it work, and we got a 6-issue series out of Bernie, and it was incredible. Bernie is, you know, he was just the sweetest and kindest man. So that was a favorite. And then after, in the process of doing that, he asked me if I would help him bring his Frankenstein book back to print for a 25th.
Oh, I love those.
Yeah, for this, it was coming up on the 25th anniversary of the original release by Marvel. And, you know, that book originally was released in 1983 as this really sort of ugly little 8x10 paperback. And it was just printed on, I mean, it was a couple steps up from newsprint, but it wasn't great. So, you know, if you see the original of this book, it's like, what is this art doing packaged like this? But it was how people regarded the work at the time, I guess. And Bernie always had this idea. He wanted a big hardcover. He wanted really fancy, thick art paper. And so I did that book with him. And it was just such a beautiful thing to be able to sort of be his partner in making that happen. And to give somebody like Bernie, who just really, I thought, deserved the world and hadn't really gotten it as much as he had put out into the world, I don't think he had gotten quite as much in return. So I felt really good helping him make that happen at exactly a great time. So the 25th anniversary, it was a great seller. It was a really good thing.
I warned you that I was going to pick your brain about Bernie Wrightson, because I feel like you have a really nice relationship with him.
Yeah.
And I never got to meet him, you know, but he's somebody that I know as a horror comics fan, that like, he's such a backbone of the genre. And tell me, you were telling me some interesting stuff the other day, and I said, no, let's talk about it on the show.
Yeah.
About Bernie, like, and how he's kind of influenced horror today, and like what's happening today that still has pieces of him in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the clearest example of that was Bernie's been, he died a little over a year ago. He died last March. He had a brain tumor, and he couldn't quite beat it. And I think it was the week after he died, at the end of that week's episode of The Walking Dead, they ran a very sweet little tribute to him as the last, you know, the closing frame of the show.
That's nice.
Literally everybody who works on that show is a Bernie Wrightson devotee. And, you know, people grow up to do things like make zombie TV shows because they read Bernie Wrightson comics when they were kids, you know. And I think a lot of people who work in horror today who are, you know, my age or older, you know, in 40s, I think anybody who's interested in horror at some point had come across Bernie Wrightson. You know, he did illustrations for Stephen King books in the 80s. He co-created Swamp Thing with Len Wein. So he's really everywhere in horror. And even I interviewed Bernie's son, John Wrightson, who is an amazing makeup effects artist. And he basically, I mean, he sculpts and makes prosthetics for horror films and television that looks, they really look like Bernie's work come to life. So there's definitely a genetic thing going on there where it's incredible how similar their work is, but John's work is in an entirely different medium. So I interviewed John Wrightson for an article I wrote for the new IDW magazine, Full Bleed. That was a tribute to Bernie, because I wanted to talk to him about what it was like being a kid with that kind of artistic talent and being the son of somebody like Bernie Wrightson, who is just this legend. And, you know, you could see that going a couple of different ways. But luckily, Bernie was just such a big hearted and loving guy. He was very supportive of his son and really encouraged him. And I just love that when you look at John's work, you can see this absolute love and adoration for his father in it. So it's just beautiful. It's, you know, it's a beautiful, it's a little painful. It took me something like 4 months to write that article for IDW because I just kept sobbing. I would start writing it and I would just start missing Bernie and think about him. And he was just, you know, he was just a sweetheart, and he was very appreciative of finding somebody like me to work with at a publisher like Dark Horse, I think, because he hadn't had quite that same experience where he really bonded with somebody. So, you know, we used to get off the phone after on a Friday, he would call me and he would just tell me that he loved me and that he was grateful that I helped him get through the week, you know.
Well, what a sweetheart.
So you think about, you know, horror legends and how they must, and especially somebody like Bernie's this high profile guy in the comics industry. And oh my God, he was appreciative for everything he got out of people and for, you know, every bit of attention and, you know, people who wanted to listen to him and help him make his best work. He didn't get that everywhere. So, it was a lovely bond we had. And I feel very, very, very fortunate that I was in that role at that time and I got to do that with him.
It says a lot, you know, on Talking Comics, we did a little thing at the end of the show when he passed to talk about him and his work. And it was a little bit mind blowing to watch all of the different artists and writers and people in the industry who had lovely stories to share about him and things to say about him.
Yeah, I mean,
when that happened, it says so much about who he is as a person that all of these people just wanted to gush about how much they love him. You know, Neil Gaiman and Del Toro and Mike Mignola, all these heavy hitters in the industry that just wanted to come out and say thank you to Bernie.
Yeah. And he was also one of the things that I wrote about in the Full Bleed article was how encouraging he was to young artists. Even, you know, people would come up to him so hopeful and say, will you look at my portfolio? And even if it was sort of terrible, he would find something positive and encouraging to say. And if he liked it, he would walk, you know, a kid over to a high profile editor and say, you should look at this portfolio for this kid.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's the kind of guy he was. And so I just think that's, you know, very few people will just even take a second of their time to help somebody they don't know, much less, you know, put a couple of more minutes into it just to make somebody's experience really fully rounded and positive. And I heard stories like that all the time from people I knew when they were like, oh, wow, you're working with Bernie. This one time he did this lovely thing for me, you know?
Yeah.
So losing Bernie was definitely just a major blow, I think, to comics in general, but what a legacy. He's, you know, there's so much of his work out there. There will be new stuff from him to discover for a long time because he did a lot of little things that haven't been republished yet. IDW sort of has a connection with Bernie's wife, Liz. And I hope that means that they might do some more of his older stuff. Who knows?
I think I just covered recently on Talking Comics, they republished those Frankenstein books.
We did, yeah.
Like in a couple volumes, yeah, because I read them for the show and they were it was really fun to go back and see those again.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And I mean, one of the sweetest things is that our mutual friend, Kelly Jones, who is a well-known, you know, I guess less for horror comics. He's, you know, Kelly is really known for his work at DC on Dead Man and Batman. But Kelly is a huge Bernie fan. And before he died, Bernie called Kelly and asked him to finish drawing Frankenstein for him because he knew Bernie knew he wasn't going to be alive to finish it. And that was just what a beautiful but heavy
honor.
Yeah, what an honor. But it was also, you know, Bernie was one of Kelly's best friends too. So that was a very emotionally laden experience for him. And, yeah. You know, like a lot of recognition of Kelly's own artistry and just what an amazing creator he is, but also literally carrying this emotional burden of finishing one of his best friend's unfinished work. Yeah, so there's a lot in that whole series that is really heavy and beautiful. You asked a question about the hardest comics to work on. And if you want to circle back to that, I can, and I can try to keep that sort of quick.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted, I think before we let you go, I think the biggest thing I'd like to hear you talk about is maybe horror as a parent. Like,
we talk
a lot about like kids horror on the show here and how that's changed over the years. And I think I talk a lot about how horror and digesting horror has changed for me as a parent.
Yeah.
Is it changed for you, do you think, since Elliot came into your life?
It really has. Like, one of my favorite horror movies of, you know, the last couple of decades is The Orphanage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one. And I don't think I could watch that movie today. I just think it would gut me too much because it's focused around a very small boy and what happens to him in this house. And it's just, you know, it's a beautiful story, but I just don't know if I would need to deal with that level of grief again. I'm really glad I saw it. Similarly, you know, I was really excited to see it in the theaters, but it was really hard to watch kids being hunted. You know, it was really it was much more resonant emotionally than it was when I read that book as a 12-year-old kid, when I was one of the kids in my head in the story. You know, I've always sort of read horror and participated in horror stories as like, ooh, I'm like the kid in the woods running from this creature. But now I'm the parent of the kid in the woods running from the creature. And it can be really devastating to think about it. And in a way, I think that makes it more effective because horror is all about pushing emotion. But yeah, it's definitely, it's challenging. I'm trying to think if there was some, oh boy. Yeah, I'm trying to think of there was some other show I watched or a movie I had watched in the last year or so that had a sort of focus on something bad happening to a kid.
Has Elliot been able to see anything that you would consider like kids horror or like scary? Yeah. Like how far does he delve into scary stuff yet?
Well, we're at an age right now. So he's going to be 5 next month. And right now this is so corny, but it is one of the sort of gateways. He really loves Scooby-Doo. Like the old cartoons.
Yeah,
the old cartoons.
The best.
You know, and he's really into the concept of a mystery and clues and finding out what happened. And he also, you know, we're big Halloween fans around here. So I've indoctrinated him nice and early about, you know, I remember taking him trick-or-treating when he was not quite 2. And we practiced walking around the neighborhood and just looking at the scary decorations because, you know, he didn't even want to look at the decorations. And he got that they, you know, like skeletons still sort of freak him out. And that's a real, you know, and when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, skeletons are like existentially horrifying because we are all skeletons in meat suits. And, you know, like that kind of thing when you think, you know, so when I was first even just talking about what skeletons are and explaining to him that like a skull is just a human head with no skin on it, just whoa, that gets
weird. That's the most terrifying way to say it.
It is. that's probably not how I explained it to him, but you know, I was like, look at your, and you know, the other thing is like, look at your teeth. Your teeth are the only part of your skeleton that is exposed. And it's like, oh my God, that's horrifying. So I love having a kid's perspective on that because, you know, there are all these things that are just sort of disturbing that we just accept as fact every day. And, you know, so he's into, of course, I got like all the little kids' Halloween board books with just ghosts and cute little witches and that kind of stuff in it.
Speaking of costumes, Sierra, you and Jackie need to go back and stalk Shauna a little bit and find some photos of Elliot's costumes because she has built him some of the most incredible costumes.
Oh, yeah? Nice.
I'm jealous. I'm jealous of your costume building skills.
You know, that really started when he was 6 months old on his first Halloween, and I was, you know, getting used to being home a lot and being a mom, and I was working at the time, but you can only work so much with a 6 month old. And there were days we were just sort of, I felt like sort of trapped in the house. And I was like, well, I have some felt in the basement and I have some wire cleaner, you know, some, what are those things called? Pipe cleaners. And yeah, it's like, I would just make him a ridiculous costume. So his first Halloween, he had 6 different costumes just because I was like,
that's excellent.
You know, I think my very favorite one was, I dressed him up as Quint from Jaws. Because we just have this, we have this great big stuffed shark.
That was so fantastic.
And it was so funny. And so I just put in my, you know, just rummaged through his clothes. And I'm like, hey, here's a little denim shirt. And here's a little bandana to put around his head. And then I laid him on the couch with a red blanket, a blue blanket on the bottom for the water. And then a red blanket on top of that for the blood. And then I laid him on the couch and I stuck the shark on top of him. And it looked like the scene where Quint is sliding into the shark's mouth and Jaws.
That's awesome.
That's pretty much how I kept myself sane the first year of parenting, because, you know, it's like you have to find yourself and a way to express yourself as a parent when you're really put in this bizarre role of like, oh my God, I'm a mommy now. And I don't know if I get to be weird anymore. I don't know if I get to like anymore. I don't know if I get to tell bad jokes anymore. So that was sort of how I found my way through all that, was just by trying to be creative with him.
He was also an absolutely perfect Charlie Brown.
Well, yeah, I guess, I mean, the Charlie Brown is really the best because at that age, Elliot was a perfect, like his head was literally like, you look at Charlie Brown in the Halloween special when they use him as a model for the pumpkin. Elliot's head was perfectly round and he had this perfectly fat little. And the only thing you need to do to dress a kid up as Charlie Brown really is draw the little curl on the forehead if they're bald. And Elliot was perfectly bald. So I just used black eyeliner and I drew that little curl on his forehead and instantly he looked like Charlie Brown, but I also did the shirt and all that nice stuff. But yeah, it was really fun. And now Halloween has, you know, he's definitely like, it's all his ideas, what he wants to do. But I was very proud of his last Halloween costume this past Halloween. He was a mountain covered with spiders. What? With ghosts flying around.
Yeah, that's so good.
And that was like his very first idea. I was like, what do you want to be for Halloween? And he was like, I want to be a mountain covered with spiders with ghosts flying around. And I was like, fuck yeah, we're gonna do that. So I made him this ridiculous, it was a really ugly costume actually. I wish I had more time to spend on it. I also have the aesthetic that for kids costumes, you don't go out and spend a lot of money, you just sort of look around and put it together.
Uh-huh.
So I made it with, it was chicken wire and it sort of made him this little hoop skirt to be a mountain. I sewed a bunch of big Halloween spiders to it. And then I put these little tissue ghosts sticking up on paper nice clips flying around, you know. It was very funny. Very, very funny. And the best part was taking him trick-or-treating and having people ask him, what the hell are you? Oh, and here he comes. He must have heard me talking about him. Hi, Elliot. I'm talking to these ladies here on this computer, but you can't. Say hi.
Hi.
I was just telling him about.
Hi. Elliot.
I was just telling him about your Halloween costume last year. These are ladies who like scary things. Do you like scary things?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your favorite scary thing?
Funny ghosts.
Funny ghosts. See, nice. That helps.
Funny ghosts.
That's a good answer.
It helps if the ghosts are funny.
We like funny yeah ghosts too.
I'm not afraid of anything.
And Elliot's also not afraid of anything. He says that. I don't think it's true.
It is true.
It is true. Okay.
It's definitely true.
I kind of love how Elliot's sort of like the neighborhood like cat mayor too. You guys are like going on these strolls through the neighborhood, and he just like finds random cats everywhere and becomes their best friend instantly.
We call that that's called cat patrol.
it has a name, Melissa.
I've been doing cat patrol for years by myself, and I was very lucky to have a little person come along with me who likes to do it too.
Yeah, I guess I harassed Jackie before we started this that you guys weren't allowed to talk about bunnies too much, and you didn't talk about bunnies at all, so.
It's okay. We'll talk about it on Facebook.
Scary bunnies.
That's important. And it's probably good. You guys all know I'm down. I have no bunny right now.
No.
And so I'm heartbroken with no bunny. But I have my eye on this. Oh, Sierra, my bunny, my next bunny is in Seattle, actually. There's a there's a really cool rescue run out of Seattle, and a good friend of mine who works at Fantagraphics is a crazy bunny lady too.
Yeah,
and she sent just a few weeks after my bunny Billie Jean died, she sent me this link. Just have to look at this rabbit, and he's this great big boy. He's this big fuzzy. He's like 10 pounds. He's huge.
That's a lot of bunny.
Oh my gosh!
And I like that a lot, actually. Billy wasn't that big. She was not quite 8 pounds, but she was pretty big and just boisterous. So, but this boy bunny in Seattle is a big snuggler, and he just likes to like sit on your lap and snuggle.
No, that's awesome.
Well, it's what you want.
I just hope he likes horror movies, because that's my thing, is like snuggle with a bunny, watch a horror movie. Everything is good.
We have one bunny that specifically likes police procedurals. It's weird. It's totally weird.
I could totally see that. Yeah.
But she's into it.
I love it.
We used to have a lot of bunny appearances on this show, but then Jackie kicked them all out of the recording room. So.
No, what I did was I got them a better water bottle. they did still come over and beg for treats in the middle of recordings, though. But
We used to hear them drinking through the recording.
Oh, yeah.
How is something that's 3 pounds so loud?
Oh god, they're such assholes. That's the thing. Rabbits are just total assholes most of the time, and I love them for it. That's one of the reasons they're
so adorable assholes.
Cute and terrible all the same time.
Well, Shauna, thank you so much for joining us. I think you're obviously in high demand tonight, so we should probably let you go.
For toddlers and
Elliot's not going to tolerate us much longer.
No, I'm pretty happy it went that well. But thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to talk to you guys, and I really appreciate the work you do to keep horror out there and available to all sorts of people, especially women. So thank you for that.
Thank you. That's awesome to hear.
Good luck on your new job.
Thank you. I'm hoping I can be developing some horror series before too long. They know that that's my thing. So if anything really cool crops up on my schedule, I will let you guys know, and maybe we can.
Yeah, we'll drag you back on here for sure.
Shauna, do you have any social media pages or anything that you'd like to tell our listeners to follow you at?
God, I really don't. I mean, I'm on Facebook and people can find me there, but I would almost bet that anybody who listens to the show might already be a friend of mine on Facebook. I have something like 2,500 friends, and only 500 of them do I know in person, and the rest are sort of comics people and horror people. But yeah.
And Elliot fans.
Yeah. And I have, it's weird, I have a bunch of followers on Facebook that aren't my actual friends, and I don't even know how that works. Yeah, you can look for me on Facebook. I'm on Instagram as Fubsy Friends, but it's mostly like cat pictures. So
awesome. Bunny. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for giving us your time.
No problem. I'm happy to do it. And we'll all talk again soon, I hope.
So Sirens of Scream is a member of the Meganerd Media family. Visit MeganerMedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. If you love our little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to us. That helps us find new people and do new cool things for you. We also love being guests on other podcasts, so if you have something that you'd like us to sit in on or a suggestion for us, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us via email at sos@meganerdmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram as Sirens of Scream. and you can find all of our past episodes, show notes, and recommendation links for every show that we do at sirensofscream.com. Sierra, where can people find you online?
I'm at Sierra Hauk on Twitter and Instagram.
All the things.
Yep, all the places.
Jackie, where can people find you?
I'm Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram.
And you can find me at Lissa Punch on Twitter and Instagram. And you can also catch me on the Talking Comics podcast. So thanks, everybody, and have an awesome evening.
Bye.
Especially hard when no one trusts you with a credit card. I love the taste of cereal. I have it for almost every meal. 5 people to a tea bag. My life never really got that bad. Not while we still had DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. Some things will always be great. DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. Even though I'm 28, DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. I guess I'm just developing lame. DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. I never got over that amazing taste. I'm not sure what they meant. Peter Pan syndrome and arrested development. Now I've been working since I was 10, but the money's always gone by the weekend. Delivering post to serving beer. I've never had much of a career, so I made sure I was always near. Comics and chocolate milkshake. Some things will always be great. DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. Even though I'm 28. DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. I guess I'm just developing late. DC Comics and chocolate milkshake. I never got over that amazing taste. I'm just developing late.